Thank you, Your Honor. Stephen Olson appearing on behalf of the appellants of Sycamore and the Shakopee and Washington Sioux community. May it please the court. This case arises out of actions of officials, tribal officials of the tribe of Indiana tribes, who sought to give themselves additional compensation through the creation of benefit plans that they claim are subject to ERISA. After they created these plans, they diverted gaming revenues to the plans themselves through the use of a rabbi trust to hold the assets of those plans. As litigation commenced in 1995 before the Federal District Court, Judge Kyle presided, that was Prescott once, Judge Kyle determined that this case had to go back to the tribal court system because there were issues of tribal law and there was a case pending in the tribal court at the time brought by the community against Mr. Prescott and Mr. Johnson for their diversion of revenues from the gaming enterprise. The case went back based on the tribal exhaustion doctrine. It is the tribal exhaustion doctrine that I want to focus on first in my argument today, and although we raise a number of other issues, I also want to focus precisely on two: tribal exhaustion doctrine and the doctrine of tribal sovereign immunity. Because both of those should be dispositive of this case without the court ever having reached the issue of whether ERISA can be constitutionally applied to Indian tribes, or whether ERISA, if it can be constitutionally applied to Indian tribes, applies in this particular instance. Tribal exhaustion doctrine was articulated by the United States Supreme Court of National Farmers Union versus Crow Tribe of Indians. There was a second decision of the United States Supreme Court, Iowa Mutual Insurance Company, Neva Plant, and in that case, the Supreme Court further articulated the doctrine and expressed that where there is a vulnerable claim of jurisdiction in the tribal court and a case has been brought in federal court, the federal court must stay at hand and send the plaintiffs back to the tribal court system so the tribal court can determine in the first instance whether it does or does not have jurisdiction. And if it determines it has jurisdiction, determine those issues of tribal law which are within the unique expertise of the tribal court itself. That was the precise reason Judge Kyle sent this case back. Clearly, there are issues of tribal law here about which the tribal court system must first opine prior to the point at which there could be any determination of whether or not ERISA even applied or whether an ERISA plan existed.
But the tribal court went on to the next step and I think held that these plans are, first of all, that they exist, which I take to mean they were properly authorized, and that they are subject to ERISA.
I can correct you, Your Honor. That was what the tribal court determined. The highest court of the tribal court system, Shakopee Appellate Court, on review, on our appeal, determined that these plans were never properly approved. Pursuant to community law, the affairs of this governmental instrumentality, that is what the LTIF is, it is a governmental instrumentality through which the community exercises its constitutional authority to conduct this gaming activity. Gaming activity, which under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, 25 U.S.C. section 2710B2A, can only be conducted by a tribal government. This is tribal activity, tribal governmental activity in which the tribe itself is engaged. As a matter of fact, in one of the cases that is contained in the appendix, the very case was pending in the tribal court at the time when Judge Kyle heard the initial complaint in federal court regarding the ERISA claims, LSI versus Prescott and Johnson. In that case, the tribal court said that these officials, as a matter of fact, Prescott and Johnson themselves argued, these officials are tribal officials. They're protected by sovereign immunity, even from claims that are brought by the community itself. So when this case went back, the ERISA case went back, the tribal appellate court reviewing the tribal court determined that these plans were not approved as required by the board of directors. Section 8.6 of the Articles of Incorporation, Limit 6, required compensation to be set by the board of directors. Deferred compensation plans, particularly where there's a trust arrangement, a rabbi trust arrangement such as this, under ERISA. These are unfunded plans, which are referred to in the parlance of ERISA as being non-qualified deferred compensation vehicles that are available for highly compensated employees. They are what is referred to as top hat plans. These top hat plans are usually funded through the creation of a trust that holds the assets that will then fund the plans. That's precisely what was done by the plaintiffs here. They diverted tribal gaming revenues to a trust. The trust held the assets, and the assets of that trust were the subject of the suit in the tribal court, as well as the validity of the plans. When the tribal appellate court looked at this situation, it said, number one, there is no approval by the board of directors to lose the record. None. So these plans were never properly approved. Because they were never properly approved, they cannot validate the officers. Under community law, the only way in which these officers can be compensated for gaining revenues is if those gaining revenues have been approved as compensation by the board of directors. The board of directors of a corporation is comprised of individuals drawn from the governing body of the tribe. This is a tribal governmental enterprise.
Now, where Judge Doty disagreed with you, he said, yeah, I agree that the board of directors should have approved this, but because the plans were put into effect and were in effect for a considerable period of time, I'm going to say that that corrected the lack of formal approval. That's about what he said, right?
That is a fair summary of Judge Doty said. Judge Doty, really, if you look at the exhaustion doctrine, this court's formulation of that doctrine is expressed in Duncan Energy versus Three Abilities of Crimes. There, this court said that there is required to be deference given by the federal court to determinations of tribal law. Those can't be reconsidered. It's the tribal court that has the authority and the understanding of tribal law to interpret that law. In this particular case, the inquiry should have ended at the point at which the tribal court said these plans could not exist under tribal law. The inquiry by the federal court, like Judge Doty, should have ended there, because proper deference requires that if the plans can exist, if they can't be legal under the law of that particular sovereign, because they are an illegal attempt to provide compensation to these individual tribal officials by themselves, then under those circumstances, the inquiry should have ended. The inquiry should have been another reason.
Did they control the board at that time? Or was that part of Judge Daly's, Judge Golden's decision that because they controlled the board, that the formal action wasn't necessary?
No, that wasn't. Judge Golden's decision really relied on the factual doctrine of, I shouldn't call it a doctrine, the application of certain equitable principles that were first articulated, I believe, by the 11th Circuit, Jonathan D. Billingham. And in that case, the court determined that where there is evidence that a plan exists, the court can find, as a matter of equity, that a plan does exist. Judge Doty misconstrued the actions of the tribal court system, relied on the determination of the tribal appellate court, not the determination of the tribal court system itself, as articulated by the relied on the determination of the tribal trial court, rather than on the determination of the tribal appellate court, and said, these plans were approved, and even if they weren't, under this de facto equitable doctrine that exists with respect to these plans, we deem these plans to exist. But there's a reason why that equitable doctrine should not apply here. Mr. Prescott was the chairman of the board of directors. The board of directors had responsibility for approving compensation. He could have brought these plans to the board and had them approved by the board. The board never approved these plans. There are some vague references, as the tribal appellate court's decision makes clear, in the minutes of the board of directors to people giving reports about the possibility of there being plans at some point in the future. But there is no evidence of record anywhere before this court or any other court that these plans were properly approved. They were never properly approved. Now, with respect to the fact
that this is just a matter of the relationship between the federal courts and the tribal court. From what you're saying, I gather that the Travel Court of Appeals found that under tribal law these plans were never properly approved. Is that binding on a federal district court?
That aspect of tribal law, that determination of tribal law, is clearly binding on the federal court. If you look at what this court said in Duncan Energy, unless a federal court determines that the tribal court lacked jurisdiction, which clearly the tribal court here had jurisdiction to determine whether these plans were or were not approved under tribal law, proper deference to the tribal court system precludes relitigation of the issues raised and resolved in tribal court. Precludes relitigation of the issues. That's precisely what the plaintiffs and the appellees are attempting to do here. They are attempting to relitigate something that has been litigated for over 10 years, and they're attempting to do it by acquiring the ill-gotten, or attempting to do it in an effort to acquire the ill-gotten gains of their illegal activities. I see my light is on. I want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
How much money is involved in this?
Somewhere over $1 million.
Somewhere over $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Or about $1 million, I believe.
And again, Judge Doty's response to the Duncan case was to say what? Doesn't really mean what it says? Or?
No, his response to the Duncan case was to say that the deference is required to be given to the tribal court on matters of tribal law, but then he sort of skipped what it was that the tribal appellate court said and focused instead on what the tribal court said, which was these plans were adopted, therefore they're subject to ERISA. The other piece of what Judge Doty said is that on findings of fact by the tribal court system, unless the findings are clearly erroneous, the federal courts are required to abide by those findings of fact. In this case, one of the findings of fact of the tribal appellate court is that these plans were never adopted by the Board of Directors. Another finding of fact, which is particularly significant here, particularly in light of this de facto equitable doctrine that applies in ERISA cases, is that in this case, these plans were not created by the employer for the employee. These plans were created by the plaintiffs themselves. They created the plans, not the board, not the employer. If you read that decision at page, I believe it's at page 142, the tribal appellate court said that the claimants acted as both employer and employee when they set up these plans. They knew these plans were never properly approved. They can't seek equitable protection under these circumstances from the federal courts. Proper deference to the tribal court system requires the decision of the federal district court to be reversed, Your Honor.
Would Prescott have been entitled to seek relief from the U.S. Supreme Court by cert? I mean, what remedy, if you want to use that term, what relief does he have from the tribal appellate court's decision? Is that subject to review by anybody, anywhere, anything?
No.
Not even by the U.S. Supreme Court?
It would not be subject to review by the U.S. Supreme Court. The decision of another sovereign to which, if you look at the...
It would be interesting. It would be interesting to see what the Supreme Court would say. Has there ever been a case that's raised that issue?
No, as a matter of fact, if you just look at Judge Loken's concurring opinion, he focuses precisely on that issue. And one of the things that he says is that I do not agree in deciding such challenges. We conduct some sort of direct review of the tribal court considering the issues of law and mobile and findings of fact under the clearly erroneous standard. And he goes on to state that he knows of no statute giving the district and circuit courts jurisdiction to review tribal court decisions. And that has to do with the fact that federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction.
Well, under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, maybe the Supreme Court would say, just like we federal courts have no right to say that the Minnesota Supreme Court is wrong, the remedy there is to go to the Supreme Court. It's an interesting question.
It is.
Every time I think I understand Indian jurisdiction law, I know it as the author of the short-lived Lara decision for our court, I've just about given up trying to figure out what Indian law or jurisdiction law is.
Yes, I admit
I
that.
Sometimes
see some of us do all along.
It's easy to become cynical to say the Supreme Court sort of makes it up as it goes along, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to the Supreme Court. But
And I understand, Your Honor, and I quite appreciate that there is a certain amount of confusion with respect to jurisdictional issues. There's no question I practice in this area exclusively, and with each new pronouncement of the Supreme Court, one has to conclude that there's a new wrinkle that none of us ever considered before.
It's something like the Supreme Court's decision in ERISA. Every time they rule, it gets more complicated. But we'll give you a minute or two on rebuttal. We've got your time. Mr. Walter.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court,
Counsel Wilson.
My name is Steve Walter. I'm here today on behalf of the athletes, who were three former employees of the tribal corporation known as Little Six Inc. or LSI, and who have been deprived benefits to them under five separate employee benefit plans that were adopted by LSI. Essentially, there's three issues that are before the Court. Dialogue Mr. Olson focused on the first one. The three issues that control today are, number one, whether ERISA applies to Indians, or more specifically in this case, Indian tribal corporations.
If the plans don't exist, how do we get to that issue?
They're certainly interrelated. The second issue is whether the plans were adopted, and obviously...
Well, why don't we start with that? That seems fundamental to me.
We'll start with that.
Yeah.
I think where Mr. Olson and the Tribal Appellate Court diverge from what Judge Doney found is what is the controlling law as to plan adoption. And I think as Judge Doney made clear in his decision, he cited cases... the existence of an ERISA plan is a federal question. It's a mixed question of both fact and law, but it's governed by federal law. When Judge Kyle sent this case back in 1995 to the tribal court, he did so that the tribal court could develop a factual record. He never contemplated that there would be relitigation of those factual findings, but he clearly indicated in his opinion that issues of federal law would be subject to review de novo by the federal court once the tribal proceedings were completed.
But how do you get to federal law if there's no plan to begin with? I mean, if there wasn't a pension plan, in other words, in order to have ERISA take effect, there has to be a pension plan that's been executed, that's been formulated. And so, as I understand the argument of your opponent, is that the plan wasn't approved, so therefore there's no plan, and ERISA doesn't take hold because there's nothing for ERISA to do here.
Well, when Judge Kyle sent it back, he sent it back under the Hancock decision, and the Hancock decision recognized that there's concurrent state and federal jurisdiction over the issue of whether or not a plan exists. But the question is, what law determines whether the plan exists? And ERISA...
Why wouldn't that be tribal law just to determine the existence of the plan? And then if the plan exists, then you would apply federal law to determine whether it's an ERISA plan. And then if it's an ERISA plan, ERISA would govern.
Well, as I think Ahoff recognizes in the other federal cases that have been cited, explained... Yeah. ERISA is supposed to be a comprehensive federal initiative with uniform application.
And well, we know there are some plans that don't amount to ERISA plans. But first, you got to know whether there is a plan. And here, it seems to me, the tribal court said we just stop right here because there's no plan.
The tribal court clearly said that. Tribal court erred. I mean, what ERISA contemplates is you look to whether there's an ongoing administrative, sometimes it says procedure.
But see, that's based on the fact that there is a plan. There has to be a plan, and then you look to see whether it requires the ongoing kind of administration that makes ERISA kick in.
Well, there has to be a plan, but you look to that to determine if the plan exists, and federal courts have recognized plans where there isn't even any business.
Well, I've been on cases where everybody admits we got a plan here, and the whole issue is whether it's an ERISA plan. I've never seen a case before in which there's not a plan, and yet the argument is that even though there's no plan, under federal law if an ERISA plan. That seems strange to me.
Well, that's not the argument. I mean, it's really the plan. You see the plan document.
Well, but you know what the tribal appellate court said, wasn't it? Wasn't properly authorized under the tribal law.
What the tribal appellate court said was that there was an actual reality of a plan, that the plan existed.
That a plan had been written up, but is it properly authorized?
Benefits had been paid under that plan. Yep. That everybody understood that plan exists, but that what was missing was a signed resolution of the board of directors, which, by the way, there was testimony, which is recounted in the tribal lower court opinion. There was testimony by a former director of Talbot Benefits that the plans had been approved and that he had seen such a resolution, but that as a result...
But then the tribal appellate court makes a finding that's contrary to that.
That is what it's done, and I would note that although Mr. Olson cites from the tribal appellate court, that finding is a finding of fact that cites to nothing in the record. We had a three-day hearing. The tribal lower court judge made extensive findings, and the tribal appellate court just dismissed him with a sweep of the pen that says no signed resolution, which is not the law anywhere else.
We get back to the underlying question: to what extent does the federal district court or our court, to what extent can we review that appellate court's, the tribal appellate court's decision, no matter how erroneous we may think of it? Why doesn't the equivalent of Rooker-Feldman bar our review of the appellate court's decision?
I think the law is clear that you have a right to review the tribal court's exercise of jurisdiction.
Why is that we wouldn't review a state's exercise of jurisdiction within the state's own sphere? Here we got something that's within the tribe's own sphere, so why would we review the substantive decision? Or actually, here, a factual determination that these plans were not properly authorized.
Well, because the tribal court admittedly had no jurisdiction, I mean, it's sort of a convoluted issue just on its head. The tail wags the dog, because if there is an ERISA plan, everybody agrees it's before this court.
No, I don't understand why. Well, you're jumping to a conclusion. Our court, our cases, and every case has said that state courts, for example, can rule on ERISA claims, can they not?
State courts can rule on ERISA claims. The difference is there is clearly concurrent jurisdiction for part of our claims in the state court. ERISA says there's concurrent state and federal jurisdiction over benefit claims.
If ERISA applies.
Correct.
I can keep you coming back to the fact that for ERISA to apply, there has to be a plan.
That is 100% correct. If there is a plan, just to answer that question, part of what we sought was relief under the ERISA provisions that vests exclusive jurisdiction in the federal court over claims for plan documents and statutory penalties that are imposed if those plan documents are not timely provided.
But you get there only if there is a plan. Let's assume this plan was written by the drafters of, well, not by the drafters of ERISA, because they did a terrible job, but it met all the requirements of ERISA. We still don't review that if the tribal appellate court found that the plan had never been adopted. You might have the most perfect plan in the world, but if it's not been validly adopted, we don't get to it. So ultimately, under your theory of the case, we have to decide whether the tribal appellate court's decision is subject to our review.
I think that you have the ability, the duty, to review whether the tribal court validly exercised jurisdiction. And the problem in this case is that issue was bound up on whether or not the plans existed.
But suppose we had a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court that held that some plan calling for payment to the officers of a corporation had never been validly adopted by the company as a matter of Minnesota law, and this is a Minnesota corporation, this plan has never been adopted by the company. Suppose we took this, assume it's not an ERISA plan, and that's why it's in the Minnesota courts instead of in the federal courts. We wouldn't second guess the Minnesota Supreme Court on that.
Well,
That would be the end of it.
That would be the end of it, but your hypothetical is not involving ERISA. We've cited
well, but we don't know whether there is a plan that ERISA can grab onto.
Well, nowhere is there a requirement, even in tribal law, that there has to be a signed resolution to adopt a plan. And we cited the unreported decision.
And we don't know that. I mean, I don't.
The public court held against you on that. The argument was made, look, the plan was put into effect, some money was deposited, therefore it's in existence. And the tribal court said, the appellate court said, no, we're not buying that. It wasn't approved by the board of directors, so there's no plan.
Yeah, I think under that rationale, what would happen is there could be 50 different state constructions of what it takes to approve a plan. Because, you know, does Minnesota say you have to have a signed board resolution? Does Missouri say something else? I mean, that's where the problem comes here, is by deferring to the Tribal Court of Appeals erroneous findings, it's given carte blanche to look at whether or not a plan was adopted under a totally different test that exists if a Minnesota corporation establishes
a plan. Well, of course, it's all a matter of state corporation law, and here it seems to me it's all a matter of tribal law.
Well,
as to whether a plan has been validly adopted.
I don't think it is, because in the Bennett case, that's clearly a granted. You know, an unreported decision is outside this circuit. But this is such an unusual case. There was that case, the argument was made. There is no evidence of the board of directors' approval. Formal approval of this plan, and the court says, doesn't matter. It had the ongoing scheme. Everybody recognized the plan. Everybody acted as if there was a plan, and that is a de facto plan. And that's precisely what we have. I mean, we're three steps beyond that here. They didn't have a written document. We have the tribe paying Dorsey and Whitney $30,000 to put together these plans. These plans are distributed. They were not some conspiracy of...
How many employees were beneficiaries of the plan?
Well, there are five different plans and there's different beneficiaries.
Different, yeah. Uh-huh.
Significantly, as the lower tribal court found, in many of the major plans, when more dollars are involved, there were multiple disinterested members of the board of directors who participated. I mean, there's been a lot of disparaging statements made about the appellees and the briefs here. There's been, throughout the briefs, talk about diversion of gaming revenues. There's been similar statements made today. This case is not about diversion of gaming revenues, and in fact, in the case that Mr. Olson cites, which is appended as part of the appendix, that claim was rejected. And the tribal court said expressly, we're not going to get into this. We're going to declare that there's some immunity because we are not going to second guess decisions made by these corporate leaders every time there's a change in tribal administration. And, but to get back to your question, there were multiple participants in each of these plans who were not in any of these three appellees, and Prescott's the only one who was on the board. He was the board chair. He was the CEO of Little Six. But there were four other tribal members, at least three of which participated in some or all of the other plans. And so, I mean, the suggestion that somehow this was some backroom deal between Prescott as a director and Johnson, who wasn't a director in reverse, and was a poor little casino guy, and wasn't at any of these meetings, has nothing to do with anything. But he testified to tribal proceedings that he made life decisions based on his expectation of benefits is just totally misguided. There were board minutes reflecting discussion of these benefits and reflecting approval that distributions be made. This wasn't a secret. This wasn't something that the board didn't believe existed. And the whole sort of resolution is dispositive theory was something that came up well after the fact. In fact, as Mr. Olson has acknowledged, and as the tribal court discussed, several of these plans were affirmed Well, first there was a little, the new tribal management came through and said none of these plans are properly adopted. Now that we've said that, we're going to adopt 3 of the 5 for the benefit of our employees on a going forward basis. And we're going to ratify benefits due under those 3 plans for former employees, which wouldn't include our clients. Yet, notwithstanding that resolution in 1995, they've yet to receive any of the benefits due them. So, I mean, there were multiple participants. There was
That's a different matter that's not before us.
I understand, but I just throw it off the context, Your Honor. It shows that there's no sort of blanket prohibition on these plans as a matter of Indian law, if that's somehow...
But again, back to Judge Bowman's question, suppose the Minnesota Supreme Court found that Minnesota Corporation X had not validly adopted an otherwise valid ERISA plan because there was no decision by the Board of Directors. Would that be subject to our review?
Let me just explain as I understand the hypothetical and make sure we're on the same wavelength. If there was a Minnesota Corporation that had a plan and there was concurrent jurisdiction because we were dealing with a benefit claim, and,
Let's assume it. To keep it simple. Let's assume it's not an ERISA plan. It's just a plan, and the question is whether it was validly adopted as a matter of state law.
There would be no jurisdiction here. Obviously, this court considers federal questions.
So why is it different when the plan is allegedly an ERISA plan, but the threshold question is whether the plan was ever validly adopted. Why wouldn't that stop with the decision of the tribal appellate court, which says no, these plans were not ever validly adopted? As a matter of tribal law, these plans were not ever validly adopted.
The problem I have with the hypothetical is you would never be asked to review a Minnesota decision in a non-
Well, we might be. I mean, strange things happen. Lawyers don't always know where to go if they want to take an appeal. Sometimes they come to us in strange situations.
Well, we did go to the federal court in 1995 and just filed a holistic tribal court with the caveat that we could come back. We went to the tribal court. The tribal courts both said that if the plan is adopted, this is a federal question. We came back, and Judge Doty and the magistrate both found it's a federal question, and that's why we're here. I don't think it bears any resemblance to the hypothetical. I think it still comes back.
Because
to
I wonder if either of those judges, if Judge Kyle say. I haven't gone back to read his decision. Did he recognize that there was a lurking question of proper authorization? Or was that something that came up when it went back to tribal court?
I don't recall specifically, but he certainly put in a footnote, I believe it's 6 of his opinion, this little dicta that I mentioned, that of course when this is all done, issues of federal law, will be appropriate for review by this court. I think he clearly contemplated we were going to go there under National Farmers Union. There was going to be a factual record developed. Nobody was going to get just a second bite of the apple or to relitigate the facts in any subsequent federal proceedings. But he clearly contemplated subsequent federal proceedings. And if he had taken the approach that this is clearly a matter that can be disposed of once and for all by the tribal court, there would have been no reason to do that. I do recall at the time that I had encouraged the court to stay it, because as you well know, there's two paths you can take when exhaustion of tribal remedies is an issue that's raised. And one is you dismiss, and the second is you stay and let the tribal courts do their thing. He elected to do the latter, and then I believe, for the reasons I articulated, put in a footnote that, you know, recognize we'll see you again someday.
He was right. See you again. Someday will come. And now we're seeing, it's a really interesting case. And as I said here, I don't know the right answer, but.
we've talked about Rooker-Feldman. Is this in a way, don't we owe full faith and credit to the tribal court's decision?
I think you owe full faith and credit to the tribal court's decision. It's a matter that is governed by tribal law.
And the adoption of a plan would be governed, although you claim it's federal law. And if it's federal law, why isn't the tribal appellate court just as competent as we to decide the federal question?
Well, I think that's precisely what these post-exhaustion cases talk about, is that this court, it becomes a federal question whether the tribal court properly exercises.
But see, I think the only federal question is whether once you've got a plan, is it an ERISA plan? That's the federal question that would come into play in this case if there was a plan or if there were these plans. And here you've got a tribal appellate court finding that these plans were never properly authorized. So I don't see that we ever get to ERISA. If we are required to give, you know, to give the same kind of deference to the finding of the tribal court that we would give to the finding of, say, the Minnesota Supreme Court.
I think the cases are uniform, and Mr. Olson's able adversary didn't say anything to the contrary, that on this whole plan existence, it's federal law that needs to be applied, and that isn't what happened.
But see, you don't use federal law to decide whether the proper steps have been taken to adopt a plan. That's state corporate law. Or in this case, it's tribal law.
There certainly hasn't been a case that has come to that effect that's been brought to the attention of this court for any of the reasons. And that's where we go like this. I mean, if you come back to the problem.
Well, I'll read that case, but it doesn't seem right to me if that's what it says, that you don't look to state law to determine whether as a matter of state corporation law and in keeping with the bylaws and charter of the company, the plan in question has been properly adopted. That's got to be a matter of the bylaws and the charter and state law. And here we have tribal law.
The tribal court may very well have been run.
Excuse me?
The tribal court may very well have been run.
Yes, the Minnesota Supreme Court might be wrong.
Right, sure.
Sure.
In our view.
But the Minnesota Supreme Court certainly gets the last word on that.
Right.
And my problem is, why doesn't the tribal appellate court get the last word on that? So
I have visions of us going to the Supreme Court, no matter how we decide.
Mr. Olson has made that threat on repeated occasions.
Well, it's not a threat; it's almost an invitation. Well,
it may well be. I appreciate your time.
We will
borrow.
It's a wonderful take.
Mr. Madison, time a lot. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Olson, no doubt you have that one case that will answer the question.
Well, I believe that there are a number of cases which go to that same question, and those are the cases that deal with the exhaustion doctrine itself. But I do wish to point out that a couple of things that Mr. Walter said are patently untrue. First, we have maintained since the outset that it is the tribal law which determines the existence of these plans, whether they exist or not. If you look at the decision...
Was that an issue when Judge Kyle had the case?
Precisely. You look at Judge... You knew where I was going. You look at Judge Kyle's decision. What Judge Kyle said is that the tribal court system must determine the existence, vel non, of these plans. Not the status, as Judge Doney said. The existence, vel non. The existence or not of these plans. That is the issue that was before the tribal court. If the plans don't exist, precisely as you said, Judge Bowman, if the plans don't exist, how can you ever get to ERISA? If the plans themselves violate the tribal laws, if the diversion of gaming proceeds to these plans violates tribal law, quite likely federal gaming law as well, under those circumstances, we don't get to the question whether ERISA is even applicable because the plans can't exist. And in this case, it's clear the plans do not exist. Our theory in the federal district court on the first go-round, Prescott 1, was that these plans were never approved, consequently cannot validate this as a matter of tribal law. The only way you can get back into federal court again is if the tribal court system itself finds that these plans were validly adopted. The tribal court system in the court below, yes, found that these were validly adopted plans. Now, Mr. Walter states that the tribal court never held that there were any facts that supported its determination that these plans were not approved. I would point out that in our appendix, the joint appendix of the parties at page 141, and before when I was referring to page numbers, those page numbers were appendix numbers of the appendix itself. And this tribal appellate court decision is at 135 through, I believe, 143. But at page 141, second full paragraph, there's no evidence in the record that the board ever expressly approved the Trust Warning Association's plans. In fact, there's evidence that suggests that at least some of the former LSI board members do not ever recall approving or discussing the plans, and then cites to this transcript of the tribal trial court proceedings. So yes, there was plenty of evidence in the record. We have testimony from all the former board members with the exception of Mr. Prescott himself, but they don't recall ever having discussed these plans, seen the plans, haven't presented or anything else. These plans were never approved by the board of directors as required to provide officer compensation. Now, if you also look at the appellate court decision from below on page 142 in the appendix, the second half of that paragraph talks about Bennett. And it says, Bennett applied to those circumstances, this doctrine, this equitable doctrine, that finds a de facto plan where the employer denies the existence of the plan, applies in those circumstances where the employer has led the employee to believe that there is a plan. LSI, contrary to what Mr. Walter stated, did not adopt three of the five plans. What LSI did was say, wait a minute, you employees who know nothing about what goes on at the board of directors, you employees were led to believe that you have a benefit. We are going to recognize the obligations that exist under those plans to provide that benefit to you. You three senior executives, one of whom is the chairman of the board of directors, one of whom is the CEO of the corporation, the other was the chief operating officer. You three executives knew that there was no plan, yet you were diverting company proceeds into these plans as though they existed. You cannot avail yourself of an equitable protection when you knew these plans did not exist, because that equitable doctrine requires that the employer mislead you, employee, about the existence of the plan. Here, and again, this is both in contrast, in this case, it was the claimants themselves who acted as both the employer and employee. One final point, with respect to sovereign immunity, if you should ever get that far, and you should not need to, that's an easy question. A board resolution is required to waive sovereign immunity of the corporation itself. There is no board resolution approving any plan. There certainly couldn't be a board resolution of waiving sovereign immunity of the corporation. Judge Doty found a waiver, what really amounts to waiver by implication. He said these plans are approved based on the de facto doctrine. Consequently, because the summary plan description say that you have a right to sue in federal court, that constitutes a waiver. That is a waiver by implication that is completely contrary to all of the controlling precedent from the United States Supreme Court, from this court, and from the federal district courts with respect to sovereign immunity. My final point, and I apologize to the court for going so long, but I have to correct the record with respect to one thing. This morning, sitting in my motel room at about 5:15, reading through materials for today's discussion, I read at tab 6, much to my chagrin, a statement, a finding, a holding of the tribal appellate court in the Prescott and Johnson case, LSI versus Prescott and Johnson, when the court determined, the court didn't find for them, as Mr. Prescott indicated, through that decision with the tab 9, not tab 6, tab 9. You read that decision, what the court found is that because they are officers of the tribal government, they are tribal government officials, they are protected by sovereign immunity. Unless that immunity is waived, they cannot be sued. That's how that case was disposed of. That case involved these same bodies. Community was suing them to keep them from getting what they immediately purchased. In that case, and this is page 10 of the case, 251 of the appendix, second sentence of the paragraph, and this goes to the question of whether Mr. Prescott can bring suit in federal court. The lower court, Judge Doty, determined that Section 3.1 of the Articles of Incorporation, Loop 6, waived Loop 6's sovereign immunity, or never gave sovereign immunity, for suits by tribal members. We argued that you have to read Section 3.1 and 3.2 together, and that the two read together, yes, sovereign immunity is waived by the corporation, it's waived for suits in tribal court. If you read Section 3.1 and 3.2 of the Articles of Incorporation of this entity together, that's the conclusion you have to reach. We suggested to this court that the court ought to either accept our analysis or send it back to the tribal court for a determination of that issue. My chagrin, that issue has already been determined by the tribal appellate court. The court said, and it's speaking about Section 3.1 and 3.2, while these sections clearly allow suits against the corporation by the community or its members in tribal court, I would suggest that the court look carefully at that if they ever reach the issue of sovereign immunity. I believe that the exhaustion doctrine requires that this case be reversed and that the case be remanded with instructions to dismiss. Thank you for your time and honors. And, Judge, I am certainly honored to be part of this. Very, very great day for you.
Thank you. Well, we thank both sides for the argument. It's an interesting case, and that's why we extended the argument, and we will give it our careful attention. Madam Clerk.